All right. When last we met, we were discussing the war for existence between the center in Bavel and the center in Eretz Yisrael, the international war between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. At the end of the day, I don't know if you know the results. We're in. Patriots won the Super Bowl, and the Bavli also won the war. So that's those two pieces of information are critical. One of the striking things that I want to concentrate on today is the very uneven way that the Gemara was interpreted. In other words, even though the Bavli by the 9th century was the be-all and end-all and last final word in Torah Sheba'al Peh, nevertheless, the truth of the matter is that the Gaonim, who were the people who were in charge of the Bavli, they were the heirs of Surah and Pumbedita, of Rab and Shmuel, of all the Amorayim, they did not create a systematic interpretation of the Gemara. No commentary. You have occasional commentaries, in other words, on specific sugyas, but nothing that's systematic. The first person to create a systematic commentary on the Gemara is, in fact, Rashi. Now, if you consider the fact that the Bavli takes shape around the year 500, and it's established as the constitution of Rabbinic Judaism by 850, it means it took another 200 years and more before anybody sat down and wrote a Perush on the Bavli. Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna come to Rabbeinu Hananel and I'm gonna come to Perushei Rabbeinu Gershom, but in general, if you take a look at Rabbeinu Hananel, you know what? Let's advance. You know, lagdimata muchar v'la'acheret amugdam. If you look at Rabbeinu Hananel is very, very pointed. What does he do? He summarizes sugyas. He gives you individual pieces of information, translations of terms, all kinds of other necessary information to make sense of the sugya, but he doesn't create an interlinear commentary the way the Rashi is. He also adds the Yerushalmi on top. In fact, you can, in one way or another, actually read Rabbeinu Hananel without the Gemara. Okay? You can't read Rashi without the Gemara. It doesn't work. Those are two separate types of literary creation. There were others who wrote along similar lines as Rabbeinu Hananel. And it's important that you mention Rabbeinu Hananel because until Rashi's Perush began to spread, that's what there was. But it's not the same. It's an external act, a work which is tacked on to the Gemara. Now, if you open up, this is a point that Professor Chaim Soloveitchik makes in a number of places. If you open up a sugya without Meforshim, okay, you can more or less, if you know Aramaic, you can more or less figure out what's going on. I mean, it's written in a telegraphic fashion, okay? In fact, forget about Aramaic. Take Sonsino, which is a pretty, you know, it's a pretty good translation into English. I mean, it's very sort of stilted because the English that they wrote first of all, you know the old joke about that Churchill used to say that Americans and Brits are two peoples divided by a common language. So, you know, the language that the translators of Sonsino, the translation was done in England, used is a little stilted. There are a lot of other things which might make it a little difficult, but the truth of the matter is that, you know, more or less, you can see where the thing is going, you can see the structure, maybe, yeah, you know, in terms of things, but what's missing? What's missing is the flow, what's missing is the path, is the punctuation, there are definitions that are necessary, all kinds of other things which would flesh it out. That work was not done. And it wasn't done by the people who inherited the authority of the Amorayim, the Gaonim. So the first question I want to ask is, in order to be able to understand, because what we're going to talk about today is Rashi's Perush on the Gemara, and then The next time we meet, we'll talk about Tosfos and then Chachmei Sfarad, the early ones and the later ones, what were the differences between them. We have to ask ourselves a question, why not? Why not? So what I want to go through this evening, in the time that we have, is to go through a few of the possibilities why the Gaonim didn't do it. I mean, they were the ones who fought like the Dickens to make sure that the Babli was the only book around, and until he pointed to besmirching, we saw that they were willing to besmirch the Yerushalmi and say it's a Talmud Shel Shema. They were persecutions. You guys couldn't get it together. All kinds of stuff. So good. So you won. So take the next step and let people study it. I mean, the Babli is a better book. It is more, it is better redacted. It has more information. It encompasses everything that's in the Yerushalmi and more. So, Nu Beseder, what happened to where is the Schottenstein of the 9th century? Where is the Steinsaltz of the 9th century? What happened? And for some reason today I've been falling back into Yiddish, I'm not sure why. So, this was not a question which sort of eluded, Rishonim. They wanted to know how come, you know, it took 200 years for the Gaonim to get around to get somebody to get around to writing a parish on the Gemara. There were many reasons that are given. I want to give three major themes of the reasons that are provided, because it has implications for learning throughout the period, and in fact it has some implications for contemporary Orthodoxy as well. So the first suggestion is provided by, in the early 14th century, or late 13th, by Rabbi Nachum HaMeiri, who we're all familiar with as the cliff notes on the Gemara that everybody likes to use. Aside from the Beit HaBchira on Shas, he also wrote a parish on Pirkei Avos, and he prefaced that parish with a work which describes the same problem Moshe Rabbeinu all the way down to his time, talking about all the Rishon, all the Tanayim and Amorayim and Gaonim, all the way down to the early 14th century. There is a very good edition of this book which is really, really interesting, called Sefer Kabbalah LeMeiri. It was edited by a colleague of mine, an older colleague of mine named Harav Professor Shlomo Zalman Havlin, and he and the Meiri addresses the question as follows. Hayeshivot, he says, Chachmehem, Darkehem, Sidrehem, Vahanagatam, Hasibot Li'i Chibur Sfarim Bimea Geonim, Vatchalat HaChiburim. How is it the book started being written? Now the truth of the matter is, he overstates the case a little bit, because if you, even in your normal learning, you certainly have encountered tshuvas of the Gaonim. You certainly have encountered shitos of the Gaonim, which are quoted. There were halachic monographs, which were written by some of the later Gaonim, like Rav Sadia Gaon, and so on. It's not like they didn't write, but they didn't write a parish. So you sort of have this sort of ikar chasam and a safer kind of attitude. So he writes as follows. V'ra'ui, says, V'ra'ui sheteida, sha'adayin hayu ha'yeshivot gdolot v'nichvadot. In the time of the Gaonim, The yeshivot in Bavel were the center of Judaism. In fact, I'll add something to that. I don't remember if I mentioned this last time. There is a difference technically between a yeshiva and a Beit Midrash. A Beit Midrash, anybody's basement, you know, and in fact you have to, it's like a shtiebel, you have to have, like here, you have to have pipes in the ceiling, that's part of the ambiance, and that's your basement, and you go wherever you can have it, a room in your house, you have your basement, whatever it is. But a medrash, by definition, are decentralized. A yeshiva is another story. Up until, it's not like today you have yeshivat chor bakotel. Up until relatively recently, up until the Middle Ages anyways, a yeshiva was a central institution. In the time of the Gaonim, in reality, there were actually only three. There was yeshivat Eretz Yisrael, which wandered around Eretz Yisrael, and the lintel of that yeshiva, actually, one of them is found in the museum in Katsurin, if you go there, and it's worth seeing. And there were two yeshivot in Bavel, Surim Pumbedita. Each of those yeshivas, certainly Eretz Yisrael and Surah, were headed by a man who bore the title of Rosh Yeshivat Gaon Yaakov, the head of the yeshiva, which is the pride of Jacob, from which the title Gaon comes, because not all the heads of the yeshivas were such goyim, even though there were some goyim, but they weren't all such grace of goyim. Their title was they were the pride of the Jewish community. In fact, Pumbedita, so there was a lot of discussion of whether, in fact, the head of the yeshiva of Pumbedita had the title of Gaon, deserved the title of Gaon, or was he just called Reish Matifta? That's important, because if Pumbedita took second seat to Sura, then that means that there were only two yeshivot in the world, which were headed by a Gaon, meaning there were only two worldwide institutions. So yeshiva, by definition, is what we would call an ecumenical institution, not in the sense that we have all of other religions, but in the sense that the oikomene, it takes up the entire world. That's the reason why Rav Kook, when he founded Yeshivat Merkaz HaRav, it's not called HaYeshivat Merkaz HaRav, it's called HaYeshiva HaOlamit, the world yeshiva, because he dreamed of Merkaz HaRav becoming a center, the center of Torah for the world. Ki Mitzion takes the Torah to Baruch Hashem Yerushalayim. Okay? So, the Meir Yisrael is calling attention to that fact, that in the period after the promulgation and editing or whatever of the Gemara, he said the yeshivas were still in full swing. More than that, I told you last time that as of the year 750, when the Abbasids came to Baghdad, the Gaonim, were next to the Rosh Gola, were the major players for the entire Jewish world, which went from Spain to Afghanistan, northern India, or north, what's that, west? Northwestern India, which is 95% of the Jews in the world. Because the number of Jews who were Ashkenazim was negligible. Negligible is even in the word. They weren't even on the radar at the time. Okay? So he writes, Hayu yeshivot gedolot v'nechvadot, v'talmidim merubim toratam umonotam. Lots of, let's say the Meiri, perhaps being anachronistic, says they where you had tons of Talmidim and Rabbanim and Talmid Chachamim and on and on and on. The Kol Shekein, never mind the average guy that came to the yeshiva to learn. Kol Shekein, Roshei HaYeshivot, Vanismachim BeGeonut, that were the people that were the head of the yeshiva, Shelo HaYadarcham Lamush Mitoch HaOl Yomam V'Laila. These people learned all day long and all night long. It's a little bit romanticizing, because we know that really the number of people who are actually full-time in the yeshivas and serving Pumbedita was relatively small, and the people, when you really had flooding of populations, was during the Yarchei Kala, which were in Elul and in Adar. But alright. V'hayu yodim kol ha-talmud al peh o b'karov lazeh. That's true, because the Gemara, even though it might have been promulgated in the sixth century or so, it wasn't written down until much later. The same is true of the Mishnah. Rebbe didn't write, historically speaking, the Machlokas today is in the Gerut of Shirigon, but pretty much accepted today by historians that in fact the Mishnah may have been promulgated by Rav Yehuda HaNasi, but it was not written down until much later. And in fact, the superiority of knowing things by heart and learning by heart remained a value deep into the Middle Ages, even the early modern period. There were yeshivas, for example, there was one in Italy that I can think of in Padova, where During the discussions in the yeshiva, there was only one Gemara. Everybody else had to know everything off by heart. Gemara, Rishonim, the works. Okay? The Rambam, if you read the Hagdama to the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam expected that you would know, you would be able to, Chazaribber, you'd be able to review the entire Mishnah Torah by heart in a month. Shulchan Aruch, alright, albeit we're talking about just the little teeny weeny pocketbook that he wrote, not this huge volume that expands with Mefarshim. The Shulchan Aruch also in his introduction, the Mechaber writes that I expect you to know this book by heart, because knowing by heart is better than knowing we having books. Right? So, that's true. Everybody knew the Gemara by heart, or Karov Lazeh. A relative of mine who grew up in the old Yishuv once told me that when he was a kid, you know, people that knew Gemara Rashi Tosis off by heart in Meir Shearim was like nothing. I mean, or in the old Yishuv in Yerushalayim, it was given because you cultivate memory, and there were all kinds of ways of cultivating memory. That this is not a major, it's not so unusual. And if you don't know all of Shas by heart, Shas Rashi Tosis, certainly you know large sections of it off by heart. Think about all the stuff that we walk around with takes up gray matter and wastes it, and once it's used, it can never be erased, and you can't reboot, and there's no Star Trek Part 1 and Part 2 rebooting. Once you put baloney into your gray matter, then that's it. You're finished, And gray matter, according to most neurologists, does not regenerate, which is also scary, especially people, a person my age. Anyways. They could rattle off whole Gemaras and understand it like we say Kriyashma. It's like, why would you write it down? What, we need to write down, it's as necessary as writing down a dictionary or translating foreign words. So as a result of all this, they didn't write that much. As I told you, they wrote tshuvas, they occasionally wrote monographs, they explained selected sugis. If you go into the collection called Otzer Geonim, which is in the Beis Medrash, you'll see it's organized by Masechta. It goes up to the Babas and then jumps to Sanhedrin and the guy unfortunately passed away before he could finish Binyamin Menashe Levin. But you see, it's sugya oriented and there's tons of stuff that doesn't get discussed. The Afgam Zot, Loa Yumaskikin, Atzmam, that enforced themselves to do this, he says, Lekach Eliktzat B'nehem, and even when they did that, they wrote these little explanations, they did it for their children, their relatives, Shaloa Yubitachlis Ashleim Znebuch, you're not responsible for your relatives. Some of these big Talmidei Chachamim, their relatives never went, so for them they wrote sort of like, crutches, so they could learn. But they weren't really that important. Vayukotvim lehem chiburim k'tzarim liot lehem lefeh mehem, and they wrote these little halacha books. Behem b'isr v'heter, mehem b'dinim, lefi ha'inyana mevukash. So that's the reason. They didn't need it. What's wrong with this argument? What's wrong with the argument? Doesn't grab you? There's something odd? Yes?
That time they maybe know that they can all memorize it, but know that later generations put their own.
Okay. That's true. Okay. It's true that they didn't think about the future, but the truth of the matter is we don't generally think that things get worse later. We get caught up in our own reality, and I don't think that's any different. But, my problem is different. And we're gonna see it in the next, couple of passages. What?
The Rishonim also probably knew all shots by heart.
Good. Rishonim also knew all the things by heart, but what else? Yeah? Yeah, it was pretty, the 8th, 9th, 10th century were pretty good for the Jews of Babylonia, more or less. That's true. Although there is a machlokas between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, what induces individuals to, Gedolim to write big books, summary books. The Ashkenazi position is you need good times to do it, and the Rambam and the Sephardim say you need bad times to do it to apply the pressure. But let's assume for a moment that things were pretty stable. I hinted at what I find to be problematic before. What?
Maybe they're just there. The Rosh Yeshiva of Yerba Mina didn't need it, but maybe the people around them, even those people.
Oh, thank you. What about everybody else? I just told you, the 99% or 95 or 96 or 97% of the Jews in the world, from Spain to Afghanistan, were under the rule were under the aegis of the Gaonim. And they were ruled by the Gaonim, and they were subject to Batei Dinu, they were established by the Gaonim, all this stuff. Very nice. Okay. And he's telling the Meir, he's sitting there telling me, in Babel, B'nai Brak, Lakewood, it was great. What about the guy in Paduk? What about the guy in Cordova? What about the guy in Kairouan? What about the guy in Damascus? What about the guy in Bactria and Balkh, on the frontiers in Afghanistan? What about them? Don't they need Schottenstein too? Don't they need a parish? What? It's all very nice, It's like, there's a story that I've been told the story by a number of people, so I assume it's true. There was some guy who flew back from, I don't know if he was flying from Boston to New York, or New York to Boston with the Rubs itself. And, he was sitting on the whole, and he made a great point of sitting next to the Rub, and he bent his ear the entire time about where he comes from. It was apparently in New Jersey or in Brooklyn. How they made kolim and made kosher restaurants and mikvos and it's wonderful and they're all learning and doing and chesed and all that kinds of stuff. So when they finally landed, and I'm sure the Rav was finally happy to be rid of this guy finally, but free of him, he said, the Rav said, that's very, very impressive. There's only one problem with your community. He says, what could that be? You forgot you're in Golis. So, you know, so the question is, what about them? So if you go through the Gaonic literature, you find that there are really two kind of lanes of discussion that shed light exactly on this question. So the first one is I'm going in chronological order. The first one is a tshuva of Rav Sar Shalom Gaon. Rav Sar Shalom Gaon was the Gaon of Sura. He died around 859. Okay, this is a tshuva that was published in Tshuvas Gaonim Kadmonim Simen Mem Vav. I will tell you that my son, really, he so fell in love with this tshuva, that in fact he named my second grandson Sar Shalom, among other things, in honor of Sar Shalom Gaon and the test and the actually the sentiments in this tshuva. So Sar Shalom Gaon says as follows: Goy sheichnis yado betoch yeno shel Yisrael. Okay, what happens if a goy sticks his hand into a Jew's wine? And he we're not sure if he was Meshach Sheikh or not, what was his Kavana, and so on and so forth. It's an important issue. In fact, a critical issue in Halakha takes up, there's a huge literature on it, and he writes as follows. Kulan mesubachot zo bazo. Okay? All of the sugyas and all of the details surrounding the parameters of this Halakha are very complicated. Umafilot biyoter, and they're dark. In other words, they're not clear. The im haya ratzon, if things were right, if things were proper, vayitem lefaneinu, when you were with us here in Sura, which is this letter comes from, you know, who knows where, somewhere off in the boondocks, okay? I wish you were here with me, apparently is a Talmud of his. Haya efshar lefarshan yafe yafe. Then we would sit down, and we'd go through the sugyas, and we would learn them through, and we would, we'd be able to go through all of the nuances of the argument. Ulevararam yafe yafe zomizo. Kamot davar dibor lofanav. We'll put everything in order, everything would be clear. If you had questions to ask, I could answer you, and I would be able to know that in fact you understood, and everything would be able to be fine. You look at the student and you see, he understands, he doesn't understand, he's gonna go off in the wrong direction, he's going in the right direction. Your interaction and the eyes of the student and even the body language, all of those things, never mind the actual answers or intonations or interpretations or questions that are asked by the Talmud, you get a handle on where you're at. He knows what he understands, he knows what he's inclined to, what he doesn't understand. What's clear to him. Either what is hard for him, it's a mokesh, or he's stubborn that he doesn't want to accept your pshat. And then the teacher poshetlo ad shebeir enough. And then the teacher can respond until he knows that he's right, until he knows he understands properly. Umarelo panim kahalocha, and he shows him more properly what the proper implication interpretation of the passage is. About bechtav, but if I write you a letter, write you a parish, kama efshelo el miktzat sivanu vekedvul lachem el miktzat. But if I write to you a parish as good as it is, you could misunderstand. You might not be able to read my handwriting. You might not be able to get the nuances. There is a limit. The nature of frontal education, of chavrusa education in Talmud Torah, is endlessly better than written communication. And the minute that a mistake or a misapprehension or a misunderstanding enters into the process, well, you know, you guys know what, I don't know if you guys always know what, if you've ever driven without Waze or some kind of GPS, but the truth of the matter is that you take a wrong right turn, It doesn't matter how many right direct turns you take after that, you're still going to go farther and farther away from where you're supposed to be. So that's basically what he's arguing. If you make one mistake in misunderstanding my written parish, who knows where you're going to go? So there's always a superiority to right, to frontal education, face-to-face learning, and it's been argued that that's one of the reasons, that's one of the major reasons why the Gaonim wouldn't publish, because they wanted to make sure there'd be quality control. That if you have specific questions, you'll ask us pointed questions, but to publish a Perush would be not just, we'll see a little bit what Rashi achieved, not just democratizing Talmud Torah, it would actually be decentralizing quality truth. And that they didn't want. Because at the end of the day, it's not just, theory's bad, theory, not understanding the theory is bad enough. But if you're talking halacha l'maisa, it's your neshama, it's your shiras mitzvahs, which are at stake, and hence, and this is the case of halacha l'maisa in this tshuva here, hence the necessity, even the obligation to make sure that there would be quality control. Alright? So that is one line of discussion. Why not democratize? Why not write a paper? Okay. There is a darker element to this. It doesn't contradict Rav Sar Shalom, but it maybe would cause us to perhaps be a little bit more, I don't know, have pause. That's found in the next letter. The next letter is written about 100 and some odd years later, 110, 120 years later, by Rav Shrira Gaon. Rav Shrira Gaon was the father of Rav Hai. He was the Gaon of Pumbedita. He lived almost 100 years. He was born in 906 and he died in 1006. It was a closed shop at the time, because he was the Gaon of Pumbedita. His mechutin, the father of the wife of Rav Hai Gaon, Rav Shmuel ben Chofni, and Rav Hai became the Gaon of Surah. So you're talking about keep it all in the family. Rav Shrira Gaon is most famous for his letter that he wrote to Cairo I, describing the order of the Torah Shebal Peh. It's one of the most important sources we have as to how Torah Shebal Peh was developed and the various schools and why was the Mishnah promulgated and so on and so forth. Rav Shrira Gaon lived through a tumultuous life. In the middle of the 10th century, there were serious political problems that affected the Abbasid Empire, of which he was a part. That empire went from North Africa to Afghanistan. It did not include Spain. Spain was ruled by an Umayyad caliphate. By the way, if you have time, I'm not telling you should be Mevatel Torah for this, but if you feel like you can't see words anymore, there's a really nice series that's being broadcast on Israel TV now called B'haaretz Hayta Tohu Vavohu. The first five chapters of it, maybe the beginning of the sixth, I can't recommend because they're kfirah. But after that, they are fine. Once you get to Bayit Sheni, and afterwards, the programs are really excellent. I highly recommend the one about the Byzantine Empire and the one about Islam in Eretz Israel, because they actually flesh out a lot of stuff in terms of the context in which learning takes place. But the Abbasids inherited in 750 an empire that went from Spain to Afghanistan. They achieved power at the time by overthrowing the previous dynasty. They were called the Umayyads. They ruled from Damascus. They managed to overthrow them by inviting all of the Umayyad princes to a party and then murdering them all, except for one who escaped dressed as a woman, which is not the biggest covet in the world, especially male-dominated culture. But that one remaining Umayyad prince ran to Spain and founded a separate caliphate and sort of took Spain out of the orbit of the Abbasids. But that's the world in which he founded the state that ultimately cultivated what we call the Golden Age in Spain. But still, you're talking about a big empire that's under the Gaonim and Sur and Pumbedita, from North Africa all the way to Afghanistan, in the middle of the 10th century. In other words, 100 years after Rabsar Shalom, there were revolts that break out in Egypt and in the area of what's today Libya. And as a result of those revolts, communication is halted between Spain and Western Africa, the Maghreb. If you think of the Rambam, he says, Kol Chachmei HaMa'arab. He's not talking about the West. He's not talking about New York. He's not talking about Chicago. His Maghreb is Morocco, Algeria, the western part of North Africa. In any event, now we have to try to pronounce that Bedrayan because it makes a difference. Chachmei HaMa'arab could be, you know, Dupalo, but the Maghreb is Western North Africa. In any event, the communication was broken. Up until then, when people had shilas and whatever, they wrote to Bavel and they got answers. Listen, if it was a question of whether this animal was kosher, whether the shechita is good or not, that you know, till you get an answer back, I mean, forget it, the cow's finished. But in principled issues, they would write to Bavel. But then communication was broken. At that juncture, the communities of Spain and North Africa were forced to stand on their own 2 feet. When communication was reestablished in the second half of the 10th century, the Gaonim insisted or worked overtime to try to get the same kind of respect and deference by the communities in the West, okay, to the Gaonot as before. So he writes his letter, which is published in the earlier scientific edition of the Gerut Rav Shvira Gaon, which is edited by a man named Binyamin Menashe Levin, who was a Talmud, actually a Rav Kook. So he writes as follows: Vima mor tomrun bilvadchem ki tisha'arun atem al mankuntechem. Okay. That you're going to keep things the way they are. Now, you'll learn on your own, and you'll paskin, and you'll do whatever you want, and you won't turn to us. Below yishachtun midrashechem vayishiva nishchetet. Okay? Midrashechem. And we're not going to abandon your own batei midrash and institutions that you've established while we were, you know, out of touch. Alright? Halo rashechem heima kvod rashechem shivtechem. Okay? But how can you compare Sur Pumbedita, we're the head of the pyramid, we're the top of the pyramid. What? You think Yeshivat Chor Bakotel can compete with the shining city on the top of the hill in Washington Heights or in Lakewood, New Jersey? Ma karalacha! V'yishalem haguf v'achar arosh haguf holech. You are the body, we are the head. You have to realize that you are dependent on us. Hakitzu na'achenu v'habitu ba'ele. Look at what we have here. V'simu kavod l'shem alokechem l'taratou l'chachameha. U'lechu b'minhag avotechem. U'kederech horeichem. I'm missing it. Oh, that's okay. Horeichem. V'hachziru et hadavar liyoshno. We gotta go back to how things were before this unfortunate rebellion in Africa. In Egypt. V'agidu lanu spekotechem. Write us your shilas. Write us about your doubts and your questions. Lema'an tir'un et ha'tshuvot. So that you'll receive our answers. Vidbonenu bam. And you'll study them. V'gam yechazek. And as a result of that, not only will you have our authoritative responses to any questions that you have, gam yechazek lev chachmei ha'yeshiva bir'otam ki atem ponim aleihem. You'll, first of all, the morale of our chachamim apparently was very, very low as a result. There's nothing more demeaning than unemployment. And they'll be happy that you write to them, that you're turning to them. I mean, there's nothing more horrible than a teacher who has no one to teach. But at the same time, upochadim limizonehem, and they are worried about their parnasa. V'yodim mekom tarcham b'torah. Okay. What's got to do? What has their educational activity got to do with their parnasa? Because, well, you've got, this is, I'm reflecting another, we used to get svarim in the mail. And the Sforum used to be called Harke, a teacher who called it this, Harke Gigit Sforum. What's Harke, the expression Harke Gigit, where have you heard it? At Har Sinai, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu picked up Vayamdu B'tachtit HaHar, which really means they at the foot of the mountain, but the Gemara says in Shabbos, Melamed Shekaf Aleim HaKa Gigit, he picked up the Har Sinai, held it over the Bnei Yisrael and said, Im Tekablu Et HaTorah Mutav, Im Lav Sham Tehik Furatchem, and since God was making the Jews, the Bnei Yisrael had an offer that they couldn't refuse, they said, Nasim Benishim, just put down the mountain. Alright? Harki Gigitzvarm, in other words, they really didn't have a choice. Okay? Similarly, we used to get these books that would come in the mail, and sometimes they were very good books or whatever, but they always came with an envelope inside, which was for your free will donation for the person sending you this unsolicited book. And as anybody who knows who has tried or thought about for 30 seconds to return something to Amazon knows, you're not gonna do it. It's much easier to stick a check in the envelope and put a stamp and send it away than to take the book, put it back in the package, have them weigh it, have them send it. You're not gonna do it. So similarly, so people would send out expecting that they would send out the book and get money back. Similarly, when people would write letters and write shilas and write requests for focused commentaries, they would also accompany these things with what? Donations to Surah, to the North African friends of Surah and Pumbedit, or whatever the case might be. And it was from that that the Kohl guys in the yeshiva lived. So it's not just a matter of, yes, we want to be able to do what we do, but also we need to make a living. And you know how much they work and how much they strive in Torah, minat shuvot, from the tshuvas that they write. Ude'u, ki lo lechvodeinu v'lo lechvod beit avinu dibarnu aleichem kashot ka'ele. We're not giving you mussar here because of some kind of exalted claim of yichus. Ki lechvod Hashem ulechvod. By the way, notice how they spell Hashem yud vav yud. It's one of these very unusual, some very unusual ways of writing Hashem in the Geniza. Ki lechvod Hashem ulechvod Torato leman lo yovdun arba amoteha. Because if you don't restore, reestablish the connection, and accept us as your head, and also support us, the yeshivas will decline and disappear. Ki afilu ravta Torah harbei meod b'mekomot acherim. Ve'ulam, that's very nice. Ve'ulam arba amot shel halacha hinehem, hinehem. Ve'zot ha-tzura, meaning the yeshivot of Surah Pudita, hu bimkom Sanhedrin, and in the most amazing line I've ever seen in Gaonic literature, b'rosha hu bimkom Moshe Rabbeinu. Lo pachot ve'lo yoter. Uminhagot Sanhedrin mehena yotzim. And legislated and customs come from here. Yotzim begalui v'yadur lefnei kidoshenu ki mitoch dachak v'tzar anachnu osfim et ha'alufim v'et ha'chachamim b'chol kala v'kala. Lo kela v'kela, they weren't in jail. The kalot that I mentioned in Adar in Elul. The gorsim masechta, the kala. Gorsim means that they establish the proper text. Okay? Od masechet acheret, v'kovim prakim. Prakim are also established study contexts. V'ochzim et ha'gadir shelo yiparetz, v'nazarim b'ashem elokeinu, u'mevi'im et ha'talmidim lefaneinu midei eit b'ito, lirot ma'shanu ma'lamdu b'shivtam, v'asher yosif nosif b'chvodo, v'asher yitatzel nachrideyu anu. Gam hai bachureinu, my son, Hi, who later became Rav Hai Gaon. So this is probably like really 960. I mean, Rav Hai died in 1038. So Rav Hai, who according to most was the last of the Gaonim in time and the greatest of the Gaonim in stature. And in fact, his name, you know, all you have to do is invoke a psak of Rav Hai Gaon and the pillars shake. The gam hai bachureinu shoked lelamdeim ulasum befiem basher lo yadalish lelamdeu derech hakushi avichabev et haderech beinenu. Says and the guy in charge of this adult education by long distance learning is my young son Hai, who is already, you know, a Shem Dover. I invite you to read the rest of it. But the point of the matter is that in that if you take a look at this letter of Rav Shmuel Gaon, it's not just a matter of pure quality to control pedagogy and so on. It's also a matter of authority. Who has the right to an opinion? And the Gaonei Bavel were of the opinion that the authoritative, institutions, exclusively authoritative institutions for Torah in the world, Olam Va'ed, were Surah and Pumbedita. To the extent that they're willing to say that we are the heirs of the Sanhedrin, and the head is the heir of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is an amazing statement in when you think back, okay, albeit anachronistically, of the Rambam's Shita that no one's allowed to say anything to compare himself to Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy was unique. It's at Shoresh 6 or 7, I forget already. In addition, there's a lot of discussion in line with, I don't know if you're aware of what's going on at home. I am. Back in North America around the letter of seven Rosh Yeshiva and Rabbonim regarding the question of women clergy in shuls, which is sort of tearing up if you don't, then don't pay attention because you sit and learning. Don't get involved in politics. But one of the points that the rabbis who signed this document, is Rav Schechter and Rabbi Schwartz and Rabbi Neuberger and Rabbi Rosenzweig and Rabbi Yudin. Who else? Don't remember. Is that smicha today, they claim, smicha today is derives ultimately its authority from the ancient smicha ishmi pi mishmi peresh rabbeinu, which was what made the Sanhedrin, rendered the Sanhedrin unique. Now, there is, it is generally assumed that the old time smicha, which gave you rights to be dan k'dini knosis and stuff like that, disappeared sometime in the early Middle Ages. There were those who argue that it was terminated when the Byzantines destroyed the Sanhedrin, dissolved the Sanhedrin, dissolved the Nisiut in the year 425 CE as a aggressively anti-Jewish action to try to prevent Jewish self-rule and the rule of halacha for Jews in the Byzantine Empire. There are some who argue that in fact that smicha actually ended or came to an end closer to the time of Rashi, which would explain why the Rambam in his day thought it might be possible to restore, because it would, if that's the case, it wouldn't have been that much of a leap chronologically to do it. But most people say, assume that there is no connection between the old smicha and what people get when they learn Yoridei or whatever it is, that's sort of zecher la smicha. That's the usual rate. Nevertheless, the Gaonim were of the opinion that even though the parameters of their rabbinic authority were less than that which were true of Tanaim and Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael, that ultimately the smicha of theirs derived and is based and is an expression of the original Masoret of Ishmi Pi Ishmi Pi Moshe Rabbeinu, and that finds its expression in a letter that was written in the time of the Rambam by Reb Shmuel ben Eli, who was the head of the yeshiva in Baghdad. So there is this idea floating around that there's substantive continuity, even though it might not be 100%. So here we're talking about the Gaonim and the centralization of rabbinic authority, and it's got to do with what happened last week in New York. Okay. So to sum up, there were three lines of argument why the Gaonim didn't write full Perushim. One, didn't need it. Number two, shouldn't do it, because educationally it's not a good idea. The only real way to learn is face to face. And so, if you want to learn Torah, you should pack up your bags, move to Baghdad, and sit and learn Torah as long as you want before you come home. Because there's no substitute for sitting and fetching a bank in a yeshiva. Okay? I think it's a sentiment which is not off the wall. And the third reason being that, in fact, the only place that can have a right to an opinion is the yeshiva in Bavel, both halachically and from a commentary point of view. they have really a monopoly on the real, what the real state of affairs is, what the Gemara means, and therefore it should be supported.
Okay.
That's diffusion of that authority by promulgating a parish would in fact undermine the exclusive authority of the Gaonim. Notice he says, it's very nice, you have yeshivas, you have batei medrash, very nice, but you guys are like, you're the body, we're the head. Okay. It's not happenstance. It's not a coincidence, rather, that the first on the Gemara, and you mentioned Rabbeinu Hananel, were developed away from Babylonia, away from Baghdad. Rabbeinu Hananel originally was from Italy. He was born in Cairo 1, which is an important city in North Africa. It was the year of Ein B'Yisrael. His father was from Bari, from Italy. Okay? And even he didn't write an interlinear commentary. And by the way, there was every reason to think that the yeshivas in southern Italy, in North Africa and in Spain, alright, did not study large sections of Shas. There is a established Sephardic North African tradition of emphasizing Gemaras that are halacha lemaisa. Hence, Taras, Kochim, Zroim, and the Kochim element, Kochim sections of, the Kochim sections of Moed and elsewhere did not receive attention. In fact, if you spend time really like looking at the Rif, not just using it occasionally on a point by point basis, sugi by sugi basis, that's pretty much the Rif as a book is a worldview. It's not just a book, and we'll talk about the Sephardic and the Babylonian approach to learning further on during the year. That a very different world developed in Ashkenaz. And as Ashkenaz, that little teeny-weeny population, 5%, 4%, never more than 40, 50,000 Jews, maybe down to 30,000 Jews, they worked a revolution. Their theory was totally different about what Talmud Torah is and how it should work. Okay? Where did these Jews come from? We used to think that they came from southern France and moved into the Rhineland, or they came from southern Italy and moved into the Rhineland up to Germany over the course of the 9th and 10th century. Recently, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik has argued that they were actually Babylonians who came from an hitherto unknown yeshiva and set up shop in Mainz and in Worms, which were the cradles of Ashkenaz. Either way, it's not important for us at the moment. When Ashkenazi Jewry begins to create, there's a whole nother flavor and tenor to how Talmud Torah should work. To give you a sense of what the differences are, and I think they'll clearly become very, 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 you'll see them very, very sharply in a sec. Take a look at number 3. This is a passage from a mid-13th century, or first half of the 13th century, book called the Or Zeru. The Zeru was written by a man named Yitzchak ben Moshe Mivina. He was from Vienna. In fact, the remains of his synagogue were excavated and can be visited in Vienna in Judenplatz. Very famous Holocaust memorial in the Judenplatz in Vienna, and when they were doing the excavations for this memorial, they discovered the remains of the Shul of the Or Zeruah, which was built around the same time as the Altneu Shul in Prague, as the second, as some of the shuls in Mainz, as the oldest shul remains in Old Buda. On Old Buda Hill, there were two remains of two old shuls, all of them built around the same time. It's really actually kind of cool. Rabbi Yitzchak Or Zeruah was a Talmud of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, and also of Rabbi Chil Paris. I'm sorry, Rabbi Yehuda Sir Leon. He was a contemporary of Rabbi Chil Paris. His Or Zeruah, for our purposes, is an invaluable collection of traditions in Piskei Halacha and Perushim of Gedolei Ashkenaz, all the way back to the beginning, and that's what I want to look at, this one thing from the beginning. This is a story which happens sometime in the late 10th century, early 11th. In other words, exactly when Shrira Gaon is writing his letter to wherever it was, probably North Africa. Okay? Im yesh lamul na'ar b'Rosh Hashanah. A baby's born a week before Rosh Hashanah, and the bris comes on Rosh Hashanah. The question is not whether you should do a bris on Rosh Hashanah. The question is, when do you do the bris on Rosh Hashanah? Do you do it before Tkiyas Shofar, or do you do it after Tkiyas Shofar? Okay. Im yesh lamul na'ar b'Rosh Hashanah. Amar Abba Mari, Rabbi Yehuda b'Reb Klonimus. This is a statement by the Rokeach, in the name of his father, Rabbi Yehuda ben Klonimus, b'shem Marana v'Rabbana Yehuda Chassid, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, who died in 1217, b'shem Rabbi Shmuel Chassid, Shamar b'shem Rabbi Klonimus Azaken ben Rabbi Yitzchak ben Rabbeinu Elezer Agadol she'erab Magensa. Okay, this is a chain of tradition all the way back in Mainz, all the way back to the time of Rabbeinu Gershon Moragola. Rabbeinu Gershon dies in 1028. Okay. So in other words, he's born around 950, 960, he dies 1028. This is the first really documented generation of Talmidei Chachamim in Ashkenaz. Rabbeinu Geshem had a Rebbe, his name was Rabbeinu Leontin. We know practically nothing about him. He's really the first, he really founds yeshiva in Mainz, and yeshiva in Mainz is the cradle of Ashkenazic tradition. She'erab magensa mila b'Rosh Hashanah. So there's a bris, kind of a bris, mazel tov, a bris on Rosh Hashanah morning. B'sha'alu l'kedoshim asher ba'aretz. Who did they ask? Rabbeinu Gershon Mora Gola. Reb Shimon HaGadol ben Reb Yitzchak, who was a famous paitan, who was a Talmud of Rabbeinu Gershon. Rabbeinu Yehuda Kohen Shasa Sefer Adinim, another Talmud of Rabbeinu Gershon. Reb Yehuda HaGadol Shaya Rosh Laneharagim. Reb Yehuda HaGadol Rosh Laneharagim is that he was one of the earlier martyrs. Ushar b'nei ha-yeshiva ha-kedosha. So number one, something should grab you. There's Rabbeinu Gershom Aragola, and there's all these other guys that were Talmidim. What strikes you? What?
They're asking Talmidim.
Right, what are you asking? Yeah, Rabbeinu Gershom's standing there. What are they dragging with these Talmidim for? So, one could argue that, in fact, so there's an element of collegiality which pops up automatically. Now, the truth is, among the Gaonim, that's also true. Questions that are posed to the Gaonim that are issued by Rav Shrira, Rav Hai, Rav Sar Shalom, whoever you want, okay, it's true, the truths were given in the name of the Gaon, but they reflected a certain amount of consultation. So that, ad kedei kach, that's not unusual. But it's always the Gaon that takes responsibility here. Yeah, there's sort of a sense of like they're all having an open discussion, and we'll see in a minute how that plays out. The Horu Kulam, Lamul Hana'ar Lachar Kriyat HaTorah. You do it after Kriyat HaTorah, the HaTorah, Kodim Shitkeu B'Shofar. Why do you do it before Kriyat Kiyas Shofar? Kedei Shetehe Bris Mila Tchufa L'Tkiyas Shofar. And so the Bris Mila should be right before, right next to Tkiyas Shofar. She Yizkor Lanu Kadosh Baruch Hu Brit Abraham V'Akedato Yitzchak. You put the two mitzvahs, the major mitzvah of Avraham Avinu, and then of Yitzchak together. V'Hediyu Smach L'Divreihem. How do you prove such a thing? There's no precedent. So he said they proved their point, or they tried to support their argument, mimadbeya shetavu chachamim b'tfilat hayom. So they brought a raya from the Marzer. Brought a raya from the Marzer. It says in the Marzer, in Zichronos, v'kayim lanu Hashem lokenu v'sabris v'sachesed v'sashvua asher nishbata l'Avraham Avinu b'har ha-Moriah b'tera'el lefanecha akedah she'akad Avraham Avinu od Yitzchak b'no agabei ha-mizbeach. Dahainu brit chila, v'achar kach akedah. Dahainu tchiyat shofar shenishchat tumor ha'il. V'od chatimat ha-bracha of Zichronos is v'akedas Yitzchak l'zaru ha-yom b'rachamim. We say b'rachamim tizkor. Baruch atah Hashem zocher ha-brit. And immediately afterwards, the samech lay and the way that Chazal organized the shalosh brachos on Rosh Hashanah is first is Zichronos, and then comes what? Chopos, no, here's the raya. First comes bris, and then comes, and that, I mean, it's a very interesting, no gemaras, no nothing. Their attitude, the attitude of these chachamim towards the legal valence of the sitter is very interesting. Right afterwards, a tanya glaze of the hainu shofarot, the chotmim shomea kol truas amo Yisrael barachami. All right, so that's a paskin. So it's a collective thing. They all agreed. They asked the Rosh Hashiva. They replied, by the way, as a group or as individuals. It's not that afterwards Ragmap Rabbeinu Gershom paskin. This is what it is. No. There's a sense of collective and collegiality which remains, because as opposed to in the among the Gaonim where whoever was consulted stays anonymous, here every single person is a Gavra. Now it gets even more interesting. The Harbe Mibnei HaYeshiva HaKdosha Haya Kashe Beinehem Laket Kiat Shofar Kol Kach Bishvil Hamila Viratzu Lidchota Adgmar Kol HaTfila. The Bachrim didn't like it. We don't want to wait for the Kiddush Shofar. We want... Hello? All of... Rabbeinu Gershom, Rabbeinu Yehuda, Rabbeinu Lazar, Rabbeinu Shimon, all the guys say, absolutely this way. And the yeshiva guys, they're screaming, no, 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 we object. The Hashivim and Rabbeinu Gershom had to reply, Im ein mila ein kiat shofar ba'olam. Shenemar im lo briti yomam v'layla chukot haaretz hashemayim v'aretz lo samti. V'od the mitzvah mila kadma l'tkiyah shofar. Okay? What happened? In other words, it's a psak halacha. It's Shana morning. And they're having this big argument. This is very different. This is a very open, freewheeling sort of discussion in which the younger guys in the yeshiva have no hesitation to sit there and throw kashas and objections halakha lamaisa at the gdolei ador in the yeshiva. If you're talking about an aristocratic sort of closed shop geonim world, this is whoa all over the place. Okay, Vania Katan. Says Rebbe Elazar Mivor Maizah, whose words are being quoted here by the Orz HaRuah, the Rebbe Elazar words of the Baal Rukeach, Vania kot matzati smach ledivrayim b'tshuvat ha-geonim. Oh, by the way, tshuvat ha-geonim. Tshuvat ha-geonim? Who are the Jim? Rebbe Elazar, Rebbe Yehuda, Rabban Aklonimus, Azokein, Ish Romi, Ben Rabban Ashabtai, Bevol, the Medinas Germais Lachar, Tiras, Rebbe Yaakov, Ber Yakar. He says, I have a raya on this issue, we'll see with the Raya in a minute, from the Gaonim. Many quotes, doesn't quote Rav Paltoi, doesn't quote Natronoi, doesn't quote Rasar Shalom. He refers to a tshuva that was written by other later Ashkenazi Gedolim, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shlok, Klonimus, Rabbi Yaakov ben Yaakov Rashi, who was Rashi's major Rebbe. He calls them Gaonim. Now that's an important thing. Why is it an important thing? Because I told you, the title Gaon was reserved for whom? The heads of those two yeshivas. And now, he's calling these people who lived 50 years after Rav Hai died, they're Gaonim. The Rambam says it also, in the Hakdama to the Mishnah Torah, everybody lived that time in the Gemara, they're called Gaonim. The implication of both of them is, that we do not subscribe on principle to this idea that the people in Surah and Pumbedita, with all the covet we have for them, have a monopoly on Torah and therefore we have to defer to them. Anybody who reaches a level of achievement, he's also a gong. Sha'alumi menu. So they asked on this question, the very same question. Shalom imen davar zeh, v'otzi chotam edut kodesh, v'era michtab shekvar nishalu she'la zo b'mata romi. That this question was asked already in Rome in the 11th century, which was another yeshiva. Bo sha'al mar shlomo ha-yitzchaki, it's not Rashi. Min rabbana marana rabnatan gaon. Calls it Rav Nassim ben Yechiel, who wrote the first established Talmudic dictionary before there was Jastrow, before there was Shechter, before there was any we used still Malamed. What do you use today for Aramaic? Yeah. You still use Jastrow? Okay, well I recommend Malamed, but okay. In any event, but he calls him. But the Aruch was the first of these. There was the first dictionary encyclopedia of halacha, and he calls him also a gaon. Shechiber sefer nikra aruch. He died in 1103. Umin mar Daniel achiv, umin mar Abraham achiv. There was a yeshiva in Rome, which you can actually, if you visit Rome, you can visit the building in which it stood. It's in the Trastevere on the far side, on the opposite side of the Tiber, from where the ghetto is. Veishiva urkam heim, shekvar nishalah beveit midrashot shel aviyam mar Yechiel gaon, veishiv b'shem mar Yaakov gaon, reish metivta demata romi. The head of the Rosh Yeshiva in Rome is also called a gaon. The minute kosher hu liot mira snif lekriyat haTorah utkiat shofar. That you really should do the mila first, just like the Reino Gershom held. So he has all these traditions to support Reino Gershom. You spend so long time, you shouldn't leave, you're supposed to be in the morning, because the reason I make the mila mitzvahs, you'll notice, I don't know if you've been to a bris here in Israel, we have this funny minig that it depends on when people can get off from work, so they have brisin in the afternoon. But that's halachically dicey. Kol kach nireh the mitzvah mila bezuya alav, and therefore nachon lahakdim liyot chufa ben kriyas haTorah with kiyas shofar. None of this, except my opinion. It's much more open, much more democratic. People have their own opinion; they can push back against the heads of the yeshiva. It's much more open and not authoritarian. But notice they're arguing back and forth about pshat in a halacha. You don't just run to the Rosh Yeshiva and say, what's the din? This is an open, freewheeling discussion. And indeed, this shift in atmosphere and lack of authoritarianism, at least institutional authoritarianism, became the hallmark of Ashkenazi halacha. So the idea of the democratization of Torah through the creation of Perushim was not foreign. Now, Ashkenaz democratized the study of Gemara in two stages. Stage number one is the change in atmosphere and attitude. Now, obviously, they weren't disrespectful to the Rosh Yeshiva and their Rebbeim and the Talmid Chachamim in their midst. But this sort of openness, let's call it democratic with a small d, is quintessentially Ashkenazic and very, very different than what was going on in Baghdad. That was stage number one. However, we're going to start looking at a sugya. We're going to start looking at the kind of parish that developed. Rabbeinu Gershom apparently was the one who started this idea that we need to go through and create Perushim for all. We learn all of Shas from Brachos to Nida, and also we have to develop the type of Perush which will make the entire Gemara accessible. On the other hand, they subscribed fully, apparently, to the theory or to the position of Rav Sar Shalom Gaon, that this has got to be done in-house. In other words, you want to learn, you got to come here. You got to come to Magensa, to Mainz, you have to come to Worms, you have to come to Köln, you have to come to Speyer, to establish yeshiva where you can in fact participate and learn how to learn and to receive the traditions of the yeshiva. But we're not publishing. We're not publishing Steinsaltz and Schottenstein. So therefore, by extension, what you know, in other words, those mesechtas you learned when you were in Mainz, if you came from Normandy, or you came from Northern Italy, or wherever you came from, to get to Mainz and Worms, what you knew, what you didn't know, you didn't know. Okay? And there was no sort of kabludati kind of situation. So I want to give you an example. We don't have time. I'm going to stop in a couple of minutes, but I'll give you an example. I'll just show you a brief example of how this works. This is a three-line sugya in Baba Basra. I don't know if anybody's learning Daf Yomi, but it's for a three-line sugya in Baba Basra, Daf Yud Beis Amud Aleph, about how much land has to be in a field before you can divide it. and under what circumstances, and what kind of plowing has to be achieved as a result, and in order to be able to do it, and so on and so forth. And there's a different distinction between the rainy season and not the rainy season. Okay, it's a little sugya. No, the perush on the Gemara that's published separately that goes by the name of Perushei Rabbeinu Gershom, but not by Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom started the ball rolling. But this was an ongoing discussion in the yeshivas of Mainz whenever they learned Baba Basra, and every single generation added something there too with different possibilities of interpretation. Four lines from the Bar Ilan Tshuva project. Take a look at Rabbeinu Gershom. Goes all the way. It's the bottom part of page 3. It's all of page 4, and it continues on at the top of page 5. Okay, I highlighted a few of the important keywords as they connect the various possible lines of interpretation in the Gemara. Okay, so. The question is, how much do you have to be able to plow this field in order to be able to divide it? All right, and then you look at the first words that are highlighted. Bachshav boy ba'ala gemara. In other words, one of the functions of this parish is to tell you the structure of the sugya. You have the answer. This is what the gemara wants to ask. This is what it wants to answer. Who's talking, and so on and so forth. In other words, punctuation, identification of actors. Okay, klomar. I'm telling you what the line in Aramaic, I'm going to tell you what it means. Alright? Next paragraph on page 4. One mahalach, v'loshen acher. However, we know that the Gemara has certain, that the text is not always accurate. Loshen acher, muga basfarim, we have better versions of the Gemara in other books, and this is what it says in the Gemara. Baha'i lishna, but the first girsa held one way, and the later girsa held the other way. Look in the middle. B'kach kibalti ani mirabenu aval chaverav hevinu b'zeh ha'inyan. In other words, whoever was the person who gave this mahalach, was it Rebbe Elazar ben, Yitzchak, was it Rabbi Yehuda ben Meir Bal Sefer Adinim, was Rabbeinu Gershom, he gave a pshat, all the guys in the yeshiva, slugged it up. You right? Then you give another version, Lashon Acher Muga B'Sfarim, at the bottom. And this is the way you should read the Gemara. I'm going to give a whole mahalach. Finally, at the bottom, this is what I think is the better way to go, V'kach kiblu chaverav mirabi. It's hard to plow through these different approaches to the sugya and the variations of what the girsa possibly is. But that's what they did in-house. But it's, oh gosh, and here the Rebbe gave a shir, the Rashiva gave a shir, and immediately, not interested. Lo nireh lanu, we're gonna give another mahalach. And it's alive, living on, sort of, you can feel already the tension in the air. Okay? You can't understand this sugya without, you can't understand the perush without the Gemara. So that's already a shift from Rabbeinu Hananel to here. Because here you have perushim which are text dependent. You have the Gemara over here and the notebook over here. Yeah.
Did this cover all
shas? No, it probably did. It didn't all survive. On the printed shas, you have a version of it of Rabbeinu Gershom, generally in places where, we don't have Rashi, or where the Rashi's not authentic. So you have it from Baba Basra, and you have a lot in Kutchim, and so on. It is likely that what goes for, it goes as, what covers as Rashi on Tanis, Moed Katan, Nazir, Nidarim, the usual ones that they always tell you this, what's Rashi isn't Rashi, you have to go somewhere else. All come out of that school. But most of it didn't survive. And the reason why it didn't survive, for a very simple reason, that Rabbeinu Hananel wasn't copied. Because take a look at this, two pages worth of possibilities, and Rashi, on page 5, gives you the whole Mahalach in one fell swoop, including at the bottom, the possibility the girsa might be different. Okay? What did Rashi do? Rashi took steps one step further. First of all, he crystallized what he had from his Rebbeim. We'll talk about this next time. He crystallized what he had from his Rebbeim. He was a genius at writing, so he could say in two words what others took 20. Thirdly, he knew exactly where to put in between the lines and in between the words, information, ideas, background that you needed to understand the sugya, to code in cross-references across Shas, so that now the telegraphic nature of the text can flow and you can really understand. And by doing that, and publishing this Perush, he took the next step forward and totally democratized Talmud Torah by making all of Shas. I have personally no doubt that Rashi wrote a Perush on all of Shas, even if it didn't all survive. But all of Shas available to the entire Jewish people. How do you deal with the problem of quality control? That we'll have to talk about. But that's the revolution. And in fact, Rashi in one place discusses the fact that one of his key teachers, Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar, who he studied with in Magenza in Mainz in the 1060s, he said at one point he was talking about a certain child that came up and he said, I know it explicitly to be the position of Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar. I never heard him say it. So how do you know? Because I have internalized his thought processes to such a degree that I know that if he were asked, this is what he would say. In other words, instead of being sugya specific, sugya after sugya, Rashi absorbed not just information, which he did massively, but method as well. Both of those together are incredibly democratizing. That led to much more widespread Talmudic literacy and Torah literacy by Jews, which was not available elsewhere. It was the absolute opposite of the Gaonim, and it transformed Talmud Torah. And what that meant, we will talk about next time.